Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, December 3rd, 2013. Abu Zubaydah and another Guantanamo Bay inmate get a day in court over their revelations that they were tortured by the CIA. The court is not in the United States, not even at Gitmo.
Revolution never sends you an omen. A revolution just arrived like the morning. Ring the alarm, we come to wake up the snoring. They're telling you to never worry about the future. They're telling you to never worry about the torture.
Yeah, don't worry about the torture.
See the horror. Spend it all today and we will bill you tomorrow. Three-piece suits and bank accounts in Bahamas. Wall Street crime will never send you to the slammer. Tell all the children in the arms of the mamas. The F-15 is a homicide bomber. Commercial for a papa pill culture. Drug companies circling like a vulture. Amaraki babies with the G.I. Joe father. 10 years from now, is anybody gonna bother you? Fire.
Musical rage from Michael Franti and Spearhead. It's called Yell Fire. And the torture regime employed by the Bush-Cheney administration, implemented by the CIA, micromanaged from Washington by members of the National Security Administration, finally gets a day in court. It's a European court, the European Court of Human Rights. And the allegation is that the nation of Poland permitted a secret black site to operate on its territory and should be held responsible for the torture of Abu Zubaydah and a man named al-Nashiri, a Saudi Arabian national of Yemeni descent. And I think this is progress. Because it's clear we tortured, it's clear we violated the international law standards that we signed treaties to. We turned our backs on the Nuremberg trials that followed World War II. And the United States committed war crimes. I think there is zero doubt about that. We play games with the words, saying it wasn't torture, it was enhanced interrogation, and it was okay because we had been attacked and we had to defend ourselves and protect Americans. None of that matters. It is irrelevant. The facts are starkly clear. And the same defenses that were trotted out by Nazis and dismissed by Americans following World War II are accepted today when they're employed by Obama, saying he's looking forward, not backward, covering up for the clear crimes that occurred in the previous administration. It's very interesting because today I spoke with Brent Mickham. He is the attorney for Abu Zubaydah. And while he was not directly involved in this hearing that took place in Europe, he offered some really powerful comments about Guantanamo, about the layers of secrecy, about the deprivation of rights, and how Abu Zubaydah is one of the best-known individuals in the worst-known position at Guantanamo. He's been told he will never be charged or tried. The government has made it clear that their original claims that he was a ringleader of Al-Qaeda were not true. But despite that, because he was tortured, he will be held to avoid further embarrassment to the United States. And it's beyond deplorable. The interview with Brent Mickham is part of the Processing Distortion series that we release at BoilingFrogsPost.com, and that will be available on Thursday of this week. Brent Mickham also wrote a powerful piece that I recommend to you, a very sweeping review of American foreign policy failures since the beginning of the Cold War. And that is published at the Public Record, pubrecord.org. I'll put a link to that article in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. And meanwhile, the United Nations is exploring crimes against humanity charged to the administration of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. I think it's appropriate. But what is glaring is the double standard. that the United States prevented the UN from making any such similar investigation into crimes against humanity committed by the United States in the so-called war on terror, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, the drone strikes. Now, I'm not saying the UN has entirely turned its back on crimes by the United States. There are investigations into the surveillance and into the drone programs that are underway. And there's been sharp criticism from some high-ranking officials at the UN and some representatives of member nations. So I don't fault the UN. It's the United States in the way it picks and chooses when it will be a good member of the UN and when it defies it and becomes a rogue member of the UN. And coming back to this trial that's underway in Europe regarding torture, the court heard expert testimony confirming how Polish officials filed false flight plans and assisted in the cover-up of CIA operations. In a secluded villa, hidden from sight, CIA interrogators subjected him to torture, to mock executions while he stood naked and hooded before them, to painful stress positions that nearly dislocated his arms from his shoulders, and the threats of bringing in his mother to sexually abuse her in front of him. Abu Zubeda was waterboarded. That's widely acknowledged by the United States. He was placed in a box. He was exposed to extreme noise. He's been through the hot and cold temperature extremes. And yet, in the United States, we're like those complicit Germans who knew where the ovens were, who knew where the gas facilities were, who knew where the death camps were, who saw the trainloads of Jews coming in and none leaving. We're all witnesses. This has been done in our names. And we share responsibility for it. I want to thank the people who subscribe to the Peter B. Collins podcast and support my work. It's interesting, when somebody takes out a new subscription, I get an email. And this morning, two came in a minute apart, right stacked next to each other in the inbox. Linda Gray has returned to subscribing to the Peter B. Collins Show. Welcome back, Linda. And Andy Betmanis, a Canadian, I don't know exactly what province he's from, but Andy took out a new monthly subscription just today. And you can do it too. Go to peterbcollins.com, look under my picture on the homepage for the link that says sign up, $5 a month, cancel anytime, $50 a year, that's our best deal. Still got bonus books and a little bit of kick-ass Kona coffee for new annual subscribers, so please get on board at peterbcollins.com. Now, the other way you can help us is by following the link, the banner ad that just got posted on the homepage at peterbcollins.com on the left-hand side that enables you to get a free audiobook download when you sign up for a free 30-day trial at audible.com. They have more than 150,000 audiobooks. You get to pick the one you want for your free download to an iPhone, Android, Kindle, MP3 player, whatever you use. And I like to be real transparent. When you sign up for a free 30-day trial, even if you cancel before the 30 days are out and pay absolutely nothing to audible.com, they're going to pay me $15 because you tried out their service. This is a no-risk, no-cost way that you can kick in $15 to support my podcast and get a free audiobook in the process. Just follow the link in the show file or click on that banner ad at peterbcollins.com. And in an in-depth interview released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, we talk with investigative reporter and author Stuart Wexler. Wexler co-authored a book with Larry Hancock, and we interviewed Hancock back in 2012. It was about the murder of Martin Luther King Jr., and it's called The Awful Grace of God. And Wexler has not stopped investigating the events that occurred as far back as 50 years ago, including the church bombing in September of 1963 in Birmingham, Alabama. And while much of our conversation is historical, we take a look at white hate groups in the South and in California in particular. It was a nationwide phenomenon, and there's still some white hate coming out of California today, as I enumerate in the interview with Stu Wexler. But in this excerpt, he talks about and actually reveals for the first time in our podcast that his investigations show that the man who murdered Medgar Evers, was involved with an FBI paid informant. And it shows that the same tactics that J. Edgar Hoover used to bust up the integration movement and the segregation protests in the South 50 years ago are still employed by the FBI today. Take a listen. Here's Stu Wexler.
It's fairly clear in the files when the FBI is kind of setting somebody up. One very clear kind of example would be what they did with the guy who was eventually prosecuted for Medgar Evers' murder, Byron Delabecque, in the 70s, a guy who, it'd be the first time it was ever revealed on this actual podcast here, was almost definitely an FBI informant who replaced Sam Bowers as the head of the White Knights, clearly gave Byron Delabecque with a bomb to take with him to New Orleans to use against an ADL figure, an ADL leader, and he was working for the FBI, and the FBI was waiting and following Beckwith and followed him to the point of the crime in New Orleans and arrested him, and that would be something that I think still needs to be looked at. I don't see quite the evidence that for that in the Birmingham bombing, although for all I know that could very well be the case. That's one of the main reasons why we need them to disclose what they knew and when they knew it, because there's always the possibility that this was a provocation run amok.
You can hear the full interview with Stuart Wexler. It's available today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com. 2 weeks from today, anybody can listen. That's how it works with our subscription system here. Well, protests continue in Ukraine, where the government of Viktor Yanukovych is struggling to remain in power. It dodged a no-confidence vote today. And in response to these widespread protests, Yanukovych is kind of trying to split the baby. The protests nominally are over his shift tilting toward Russia instead of the European Union. And so on Monday, Yanukovych called the European Commission President, José Manuel Barroso, and asked to renew negotiations on signing the association agreement. So Yanukovych is hoping that by being both tilting toward Russia and tilting toward Europe, that he will resolve this crisis and stay in power. We shall see. In Thailand, the protests continue as anti-government protesters broke through a gate and forced their way into the prime minister's office compound as police stood by and watched. Earlier on Tuesday, police used cranes to remove concrete slabs and barbed wire barricades in a road leading to police headquarters after agreeing to let the protesters into the building. So that's a reversal of strategy by the government. They don't want to confront the protesters. 3 people have died, 230 people injured over the last few days, and it looks like conflict will continue in Thailand. Meanwhile, in Egypt, the ruling junta, the military dictatorship, has completed its work to polish up a new constitution that has a huge loophole in it. And while it says that it has strong language to protect personal and political rights of individuals, one key clause states that for the next 2 presidential terms, the armed forces will have the exclusive right of naming the defense minister. It gives the military autonomy above any civilian government and leaves the power of the president, subjected to the military dictators. The U.S. support for the coup that we don't call a coup and the military dictators now running Egypt is another topic discussed in the Processing Distortion interview with Brent Mickum that, again, is at Boiling Frogs Post later this week. Also, violence has surfaced again in Nigeria as hundreds of Islamic militants made an assault on the international airport in the outskirts of Maiduguri. And this comes as a surprise to the government of Goodluck Jonathan. Looks like they need a little bit more than luck there in Nigeria these days. The city of Detroit got a ruling from the bankruptcy court, and it sets up the prospect of very ugly efforts to resolve the fiscal crisis there. Now, as I've said, there's no question that Detroit has squandered its money over the years, and they've had a series of failed governments, mostly led by African-American mayors and city council members. That said, The ugly prospect here is that the bankruptcy court has cleared the way to make sure that the bankers get a good portion of the money that they're owed at the expense of 23,000 pension holders. These are people like firefighters and teachers and police officers who worked all their lives for the city of Detroit and were guaranteed a pension. It's even in the Constitution of the state of Michigan. But the bankruptcy court judge, Stephen Rhodes, said, nah, that's just a contract. And we don't care. Federal law trumps even the Constitution of the state of Michigan. And while he claims he will be very careful in trimming the pension rights of the 23,000, it's very clear that they are going to pay a terrible price. And while this is built as a fresh start for Detroit, when you take 23,000 people and consign them to a deeper level of poverty, how is that going to help Detroit pull out of the financial mess it faces? I simply don't see it. Good news for us progressives. There's been a concerted effort over the last 3 years, and I want to single out the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin, because they've led the charge to expose ALEC. We didn't even used to know what ALEC was, the American Legislative Exchange Council. But it's been doing a lot of damage by coordinating legislation of conservative bent at state level. And they've been very successful. And after Trayvon Martin was killed and people learned more about the Stand Your Ground law, there's been a lot of pushback. And as many as 60 corporations that used to provide financial support to ALEC have pulled out in the last 2 years. More than 400 state legislators who used to be members have resigned from ALEC. And now they're in a survival fight, and they're creating a new sister nonprofit called the Jeffersonian Project to do the lobbying aspect, to try to mollify some critics. And they also have decided that they might take on issues related to gambling so that they can get new money from the gambling industry and the Native American gaming tribes. So tomorrow, Wednesday in Washington, is a 3-day ALEC summit. And they are struggling to survive. That's music to my ears, as you might imagine. Steve Horn is an incredible investigative journalist, and he does a lot of work on fracking, on the Keystone XL pipeline, and other issues related to energy. But he's turned his skills to a very interesting investigative report. I'll link to it in the show file for this podcast. And Steve, together with Carl Gibson, has been reading through the leaked emails that Jeremy Hammond accepted responsibility for. These emails leaked from a murky group called Stratfor, which is essentially a commercial version of the CIA. It's what corporate America subscribes to get their foreign intelligence. And Horn has done an incredible job in this investigation and learned that a leading democracy proponent and an activist that many people have believed was, just a great progressive international leader, his name is Srdja Popovic, and his first name is spelled S-R-D-J-A. Can we buy him a vowel? Pat, come on. Srdja Popovic came, or Popovic is probably how they pronounce it. He is Serbian. And he came to prominence as the co-founder of Otpor, O-T-P-O-R, the U.S.-funded Serbian activist group which overthrew Slobodan Milosevic back in 2000. Well, this exclusive investigation conducted by Horn for Occupy.com reveals that Popovic and Otpor and an offshoot called Canvas have maintained close ties with a Goldman Sachs executive and the private intelligence firm Stratfor. So essentially, Popovic is an asset of this Stratfor, which is probably a shadow of the CIA. I have no proof of that, but that is my deep suspicion. And Popovic's wife worked for Stratfor as an editor and an analyst at their Austin facility for at least a year. The clients of Stratfor include the American Petroleum Institute, Archer Daniels Midland, Dow Chemical, Duke Energy, Northrop Grumman, Intel, Coca-Cola. So Popovic has a code name, SR-501. Back in 2007, he gave a lecture for Stratfor, and then it appears he began reporting information to them as he traveled the world, ranging from the Philippines, Libya, Tunisia, Vietnam, Iran, Azerbaijan, Egypt, Tibet, Zimbabwe, Poland, Belarus, Georgia, Bahrain, Venezuela, and Malaysia. Popovich passed on information to Stratfor without the consent of activists that he was hanging out with, and likely without them ever knowing that their emails were being forwarded to the private security firm. Now, there's much more in this investigation, but I will link to it. I want you to read it for yourself. See the connections that Popovich has cultivated with wealthy Americans and movers and shakers, and how he uses his cred as a street-level activist with progressives around the world to sell us out. And it's quite an expose. Congratulations to Horn and Gibson for some great work there. Here in San Francisco, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has been ping-ponging back and forth on a case related to whether public radio and television stations can be forced to air commercials, and in particular, political commercials. So, in an initial ruling that was brought from a public TV station here in the Bay Area, the weak station that ran some messages that were construed as commercials, well, a panel of the appeals court originally voted 2-1 to overturn the prohibition on campaign ads in public media while holding the ban up on conventional advertising. Now, this is an important issue that relates to Citizens United, and I expect ultimately the Supreme Court will overturn this decision of the Ninth Circuit that was just announced today. And the reason is that there have been efforts to force public radio and television stations to carry political messages because there are some viewers and listeners who don't use any other media. And there is a First Amendment issue about whether political candidates and campaigns should be able to use the public media outlets to talk to their constituents and voters. There is an important First Amendment issue here because there's some listeners and viewers who only use public media outlets, and therefore you can build a case that in order to reach, educate, and inform them about a candidate or an election, that it is wrong to have a ban on political messaging in public media. But the other side of the case is that this could open the door to commercial advertising, and that the argument is made that advertising distorts programming decisions because advertisers have something to sell. Well, I'm conflicted here because I work on political campaigns as a media consultant, and there have been cases where I wanted to force the issue and try to get a public radio station to carry a message from my candidate. The other side of it is that the distinction between what are called underwriting messages and commercials in public media is barely existing anymore. It used to be very clear, you know, Xerox has paid PBS. But, you know, we now have companies like BNSF, the railroad company owned by Warren Buffett out of Omaha, that is profiting from tar sands. And they're big sponsors of the public television news hour, where you don't see much coverage about tar sands, fracking, or the negative environmental impacts of this industry. And so the idea that somehow public media are pristine and that this is something that has to be preserved, I think that horse left the barn quite a while back. Great op-ed in Sunday's New York Times as Senators Ron Wyden, Mark Udall, and Martin Heinrich, he is from New Mexico, they're all Democrats, wrote a piece that is a direct poke in the eye at Senate Intelligence Chair Dianne Feinstein. And a couple of excerpts here. The framers of the Constitution declared that government officials had no power to seize the records of individual Americans without evidence of wrongdoing. They embedded this principle in the Fourth Amendment. The bulk collection of Americans' telephone records by the National Security Agency is, in our view, a clear case of a general warrant that violates the spirit of the framers' intentions. And it goes on to say that the new bill that came out of the Senate committee, the Intel Committee, by Dianne Feinstein, the surveillance reform bill recently ratified by the Intelligence Committee would explicitly permit the government to engage in dragnet collection as long as there were rules about when officials could look at these phone records. It would also give intelligence agencies wide latitude to conduct warrantless searches of Americans' phone calls and emails. As members of the Intelligence Committee, we strongly disagree with this approach. We already proposed our own bipartisan surveillance reform bill, the Intelligence Oversight and Surveillance Reform Act, which we've sponsored. Our bill would prohibit the government from conducting warrantless backdoor searches of American communications. It would also create a constitutional advocate to present an opposing view when the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court is considering major questions of law or constitutional interpretation. Now, as you know, I support these efforts, particularly over the Feinstein bill, but they don't go far enough. Just putting a constitutional advocate in front of the secret court, the FISA court, that won't make much difference. We need to shut the FISA court down, and we need to flatly insist that the NSA can only conduct surveillance outside the United States. Those are my minimum demands, and as you can tell, I'm not about to compromise. I don't expect to get my way, but we've got to advocate for the right outcome. And finally today, Bob Dylan is in hot water in France because in September of last year, he gave an interview suggesting that American blacks could sense whether whites had slave master blood, just like Jews can sense Nazi blood and the Serbs can sense Croatian blood. And while this seems a little bit out of left field, it's Croatians who are upset. They're saying that it was broad swipe at all Croatians. There are 30,000 of them who live in France. And they have filed charges that are now coming to court against Bob Dylan and Rolling Stone magazine. The objection was that Dylan's comment equated Croatian war criminals with all Croats. Well, we're going to give Roy Rogers the day off as we head out the door here today and spin a Bob Dylan song here. And this is for the court in France. Don't think twice about this one. It's all right. After all, it's Bob Dylan. He's always been unpredictable and outspoken.
Well, it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby. Even you don't know by now. And it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby. It'll never do somehow. When your rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window and I'll be gone. You're the reason I'm traveling on. But don't think twice, it's all right. And it ain't no use in the turning on your light, baby. The light I never knowed. And it ain't no use in turning on your light, baby. I'm on the dark side of the road. But I wish there was something you would do or say to try and make me change my mind and stay. But we never did too much talking anyway. Don't think twice, it's all right. So it ain't no use in calling out my name, gal, like you never done before. And it ain't no use in calling out my name, gal, I can't hear you anymore. I'm a-thinking and a-wondering, walking down the road. I once loved a woman, a child, I am told. I gave her my heart, but she wanted my soul. But don't think twice, it's all right. baby, where I'm bound, I can't tell. Goodbye is too good a word, baby, so I just say fairly well. I ain't saying you treated me unkind, you could have done better, but I don't mind. You just kind of wasted my precious time, but don't think twice, it's all right.